Support for this episode comes from Lawyers Mutual Insurance Company, who have proudly provided California attorneys with specialized professional liability coverage for over 45 years. And did you know? Lawyers Mutual offers competitive specialty rates for their members who act as a neutral, either on a full-time or part-time basis. So, as part of their arbitration mediation specialty program, all members receive an individualized premium based on the areas of practice their firm handles. This allows Lawyers Mutual to adjust rates annually, and as you build your mediation practice, your premium will reflect the portion of your time spent working as a neutral. To learn more about how this great program can benefit your firm, visit lawyersmutual.com today.
Welcome to the audio edition of BHBA's Mediation Training. In this episode, your host, Sydney Kanazawa of Alternative Resolution Centers, will guide you through breaking impasse and bringing closure. Let's dive in.
I'm Sid Kanazawa, and I'm going to share a few thoughts on impasse today. First of all, I want to put in context what we're talking about. We're talking about mediation where the only outcome that is possible is a voluntary agreement. We're not talking about arbitration or trials, judge or jury trials, where an arbitrator or a judge or a jury can make a decision for somebody else, can force an agreement. Basically, in the context of mediation, we're talking about a voluntary agreement. But the voluntary agreement is not limited to the narrow question that is being presented to the arbitrator or to the court. It can be anything. The parties can agree to apologize. The parties can agree to have payments over time. The parties can agree to cross-license. The parties can agree to just about anything, even though that remedy is not available in the context of an arbitration or a court or jury trial. But sometimes when we are negotiating, we get stuck. You know, we can't get past a certain issue, or we can't get past understanding each other, and somehow we get stuck, and we call this an impasse, when we just don't agree at some point in time. And why does this happen? You know, there's a lot of reasons. Sometimes it's because we're not ready. We don't have enough information, or sometimes it's because we're not emotionally ready to decide. Other times it's a lack of understanding, of not understanding what the other side is seeing, what they're concerned about, what their interest is, what they really are worried about in terms of the resolution of this case or this mediation. Sometimes the parties have different visions of what's going to happen in the future. And sometimes we have to work out ways in which we can come to an agreement about taking into account these different types of perspectives about the future. And so we have to be creative in thinking about how we take into account the different perspectives about the future so that we can agree today and agree on better terms than our expected futures. Sometimes it's because we just simply distrust our opponents. We don't trust their motivations. We don't trust their intentions. And we think that they're leading us down the path towards something that we don't want to go towards. Sometimes it's just plain ego that we want to win, or we feel disrespected and we don't want to agree because we're not being given the dignity we think we deserve. And sometimes it's because of the consequences that we're worried about what our boss is going to say, what our family is going to say, what our other relationships, how they might be affected by the decisions that we make. Sometimes it's because we're just looking at things from our perspective. We expect everybody to see the world the way we see it. We expect everybody to see the same thing and agree to the same perspective that we have. Sometimes it's because we're afraid. We're fearful of making a mistake or being thought of as a fool or loser in agreeing to a particular resolution. Sometimes it's because we're afraid of being inconsistent with what we've announced as our principles. Or sometimes it's because we're afraid that we're going to be appear to be weak or that we're going to encourage bad behavior. Or sometimes it's because we're afraid that we may be not prepared enough or making a not well-reasoned judgment about the situation. In any of these situations, most of the time, we get stuck because we're boxed into the trial story. We're boxed into that story about that narrow segment of questions that a judge or a jury or an arbitrator is deciding, the cause of action. Is it liability, no liability, and just a dimmer switch as to how much? And so that very narrow question, it's oftentimes why we get boxed in. It's a binary choice. And like I said at the very beginning, the voluntary agreement is not limited to the binary choices at trial or in arbitration. In fact, although we set things up as the plaintiff versus defendant, and it's obvious that this is why we think in these binary terms, and we think about this as a contest between us and them, and we think of it in terms of zero-sum kinds of conclusions. But this story assumes that force and power is what is going to get us to an agreement. That we talk about threats and twisting arms and using leverage, and we use language of war about fighting and attacking and shooting down and beating up the other side. And we're loath to talk about compromising or giving up or agreeing with the devil because it is in this binary kind of concept, this trial story. It's about winning. It's about winning and not losing. And so normally the mediation is set just before trial because we want to get all the discovery and do all the pretrial motions and get all the things that we can do before the trial done so that we have maximum leverage to force an agreement. But like I said at the very beginning, this is not about a forced agreement. This is about a voluntary agreement. Every party that comes to the mediation has a choice whether they want to agree or not agree, whether they want to stay or whether they want to leave. It is only if they want to agree that we have an agreement. It's a voluntary agreement. And so we have to question whether this trial story, this traditional story of force and power really makes sense when we're talking about mediation and coming to a voluntary agreement. We see it all over the world. When Hamas attacks Israel, they don't say, oh, okay, you're right. We're going to have to give you whatever you want. When Russia attacks Ukraine, Ukraine didn't say, okay, come right in. You can take whatever you want. When people attack, they have three responses. They can, the responding party can either freeze, they can flee, run away, or they can fight. And almost everybody, when they're in this situation where they're trying to get past the other side for whatever reason, and they are in a conflict where they have litigation or some kind of a dispute, both of them are feeling powerless. And in this powerless state, when one side threatens the other, when one side tries to use leverage over the other, the normal reaction of most people is to fight back. And so the more we threaten, the more the other side fights back, and more it goes back and forth, and we escalate the dispute rather than de-escalate the dispute. Now, some would say, well, World War II is a very good example of how we overwhelm the enemy, and we ultimately won, and we brought peace through that win. But what was the cost of achieving that win? In World War II, there's an estimate that there was something like 62 million deaths, most of them civilians. And if you look at where those civilians were, the Allied civilians accounted for 82% of the deaths. The side that won, 82% of the people that died in World War II were on the side that won that war. And I know a lot of people would say, well, it ended with Germany and Italy and Japan being our allies, some of our closest allies today. But really, the story of how Germany, Italy, and Japan became our allies today, and our allies then, China and Russia, are now our enemies, The reason is not so much the overwhelming force that we applied to the Axis forces, but rather it's the Marshall Plan. It is that plan after the war where we helped to rebuild the economies of Germany and Italy and Japan. It is that kindness that reciprocated into these countries becoming our allies. Again, we're talking about a voluntary agreement. We're not talking about a forced agreement. And so when we get stuck in this impasse, when we get stuck, oftentimes it's because we're thinking in binary terms. We're thinking that we have to win or lose on one particular issue, and we're thinking only in terms of the questions that a court or a jury or arbitrator has to decide. We forget that no matter what the situation is, there are many perspectives that people bring to the problem. We all have our own life experiences, where we grew up, the kind of circumstances that we grew up in, our particular beliefs and experiences as we're going along. And as a result, we see the same thing from different perspectives. This chair is an example. Sometimes you can look at it and there are four legs. Sometimes you can look at it and there are three legs. Sometimes you can look at it and there's two legs. Sometimes you can look at it and there's no legs. Our perspective may be very different, but when we try to reach an agreement, part of the challenge is to understand that there is no one perspective. We can't assume that everybody's going to see the same thing we see. Mediation is about a voluntary agreement. It's not about winning. It's not about defeating the other side and making them, forcing them to see our perspective. Now, here's the optimistic part of it, Ovin. Although we are talking about a conflict, a dispute, a situation where the parties do not agree, ultimately, most of them agree. We only try about 2 to 5% of the cases, and 95 to 98% of the cases get settled outside of court. The green bar that you see on the screen, that's 2% of the black that you see. 5% is the green, and the yellow is what you see on the screen. And so the 95 to 98% of the cases is all the rest of the black on the screen. And basically what this means is that in 95 to 98% of the cases, we reach an agreement. And so the good news is we normally will reach an agreement at some point in time. And there's only about 2% of the cases in some jurisdictions, it's as little as 5.5% of the cases. But overwhelmingly, we will eventually agree. And so when we reach this voluntary agreement, it is a situation not of us treating each other as enemies, as opponents that we're going to have to defeat and overwhelm and leverage against, but rather it is two different forces that are coming together to become one team, and we are agreeing on a path forward. So the only question that is presented is when and how we're going to resolve this issue. Not whether 95 to 98% of the cases we're going to settle and agree on. It's only a question of when and how. So how do we transform opponents into teammates? How do we bring people together? Well, there's some people that have thought about this. Robert Cialdini wrote a book called Influence. And basically, he was curious about this question as to how people voluntarily agree to buy certain services and products from salespeople. And so he signed up for all of the sales courses that he could find, and he followed around the best salespersons to try to figure out what is it that they do to get customers to buy a product or service. And he came up with six principles as to how that happens. And another professor in Southern California, William Cranel, he wrote a book called The Rules of Influence, Winning When You're in the Minority. And he looked at the problem from a different angle. He was wondering, Why is it that some ideas become majority ideas? Every idea starts with one person. But why do some minority ideas become majority ideas? And why do other minority ideas simply die and never percolate up to become the majority idea? And so both of them looked at various aspects, and they actually agreed on several of the principles as to what it takes to get somebody to agree, to voluntarily agree to either buy a product or to adopt a new idea. One of the most important things that they found was identification. That people buy products from people that they like, people who, that they can feel that they are in the same tribe with, people that they can trust that are just like them. And so Robert Cialdini found that a lot of salespeople would go out and they would find things to talk about that would make them identify with their customer. They went to the same school, they're from the same town, they have the same kinds of interests and likes. And basically, that identification allowed that person to feel that that salesperson is not a stranger that's trying to sell me something, but somebody that I can trust, that is part of my tribe, and that I can rely on to steer me straight in terms of whether to buy this product or service or not. William Crano looked at it from a different perspective, and he looked at it in terms of what kind of person, what is the status of the person that has an idea that eventually percolates up to become a majority idea. And he concluded that one of the most important things is the person that has that idea has to be looked upon by the majority group as one of us, not one of them, but one of us. And so in a simple example, if LeBron James of the Lakers went to an opposing coach and said, you know, you should really run this play. This is a play that we cannot defend against. So, you know, you should run this play. The opposing coach would think, why should I listen to LeBron James? He is a warrior on behalf of a different team. Why is he telling me this? You know, and the coach would understandably be suspicious as to why the star of an opposing team is telling him to run a particular play. And so it is unlikely in that circumstance that the coach will adopt the suggestion of LeBron James. By contrast, if somebody who was on the Lakers, either as a player or as a coach, came over to the other team and became an assistant coach, and he says, you know, when I was with the Lakers, there was this one play that they couldn't defend against, or there was this one play that would be very effective against the Lakers. And he would tell the coach that. Because that person now is part of the opposing team, there is a greater likelihood the coach will listen to him and adopt that particular play. He's one of us. And so one of the fundamental principles of how you get people to agree, to voluntarily agree, is that you have to figure out how to create a scenario where you're part of the team. You're one of us, not one of them. Another principle that Cialdini talked about that was very critical in terms of whether a person would buy a particular product is this idea of reciprocality, that oftentimes people will give away something, and their kindness in giving away encourages the other people to repay in kind, to be kind in the same way. And we see it in settlement conferences, you know, that when there's a $100,000 case and somebody demands $1 million, the other side reacts in the opposite direction, where they offer $5 or something of that nature. Both of them understand the cases probably should settle in the $100,000 range, but the extreme of one side would invite an extreme response of the other side. We're reciprocal in this fashion. We react to in the way that we're treated. And so it also applies to this idea of whether you're in my tribe or not in my tribe. If I view you as a friend, I will treat you as a friend, and we will reciprocate in that
fashion. But if I view you as an enemy, I will treat you as an enemy. Well, if you view me as an enemy, I'll treat you as an enemy. And we will reciprocate in that fashion and will not be persuaded. The third thing that both of them, both William Crano and Cialdini talked about, is this idea of consistency. That if you can get people to agree with or to announce their position publicly about something, it is very difficult to get them to change their mind. In fact, it is much easier to get them to agree to bigger and bigger things once they agree to something small. So, for example, Cialdini looked at people that go to a racetrack. And he said, and people, when they're about to bet on a horse, they think, I'm not sure if this horse is going to win, and they're trying to debate which horse they're going to bet on. But once they make the bet, immediately thereafter, they're very confident that this is the horse that's going to win. They're consistent with their bet. Their belief system is transformed into be consistent with the bet, even though a few seconds earlier, they were uncertain about whether that horse would win. Cialdini also talks about a very interesting experiment involving ugly billboards. And they went to two different neighborhoods. And in one neighborhood, they went to each of these houses and they asked the homeowners if they could put up this big billboard in their front lawn that said, "Drive safe here." And 80% of the homeowners in one neighborhood said no. And so they went to another neighborhood that had the same kind of demographics, same kind of layout, same kind of economic and social, economically and socially similar to the other neighborhood. And they asked the homeowners in that neighborhood if they could put up this big billboard in their front yard. And 80% of the people in the second neighborhood said yes. And so the question is, how? Why? Did one neighborhood, 80% said no, and the second neighborhood, 80% said yes. And the secret was, 2 weeks before they asked about putting up the billboard in the second neighborhood, they went to each one of these households and asked those homeowners to put up a small sticker in their window that said the same thing as a billboard, drive safely. And it was that agreement to put up those stickers, that commitment to this public safety message, that made them more inclined to permit them to put up this ugly billboard in their yard. We are people who want to feel consistent with our announced beliefs. In Get Out to Vote efforts, people will often call up potential voters and to encourage them to vote and to get them to voluntarily commit themselves to voting. They will ask the voter, when are you going to vote? What time are you going to vote? How are you going to get there? Who's going to watch the kids? What route will you take to get there? And the more detailed they are about how this person is going to vote, the more committed that person feels and the more likely that they will follow through and vote as indicated in that token call. It is this public announcement of their position that makes people compelled to follow through and be consistent. This kind of automatic response to, different types of situations and all that was talked about and developed by Daniel Kenner. In fact, he won a Nobel Prize for his work in looking at these types of automatic responses that we have, this thinking fast that we have. And he wrote a book, Thinking Fast and Slow. It is they have won a Nobel Prize in economics because there isn't a Nobel Prize in social psychology or more like that. But it's appropriate that it's in economics because the story underlying economics is that we are rational beings, that we are maximizing our personal interests. And what Daniel Kahneman tried to show is that we are not as rational as we think we are. A lot of our thinking is not necessarily rational. And he showed how people are willing to bet if they have an 80% chance of winning, but they're less inclined to bet if they have a 20% chance of losing. And so it's not pure rationality that they're acting upon. It is how the story is told and their perceptions, emotional perceptions, fast thinking that dictates how they respond to a particular situation. In his Nobel Prize biography, he talks about a situation that he experienced as a young child growing up in Nazi-occupied France. It sort of illustrates how our thinking, we are assuming oftentimes what other people are thinking, and we may be completely wrong, but it is our fast thinking that makes us jump to conclusions, jump to assumptions about what the situation is being presented. And it is that jumping to conclusions that often leads us astray. Daniel Kahneman grew up in Nazi-occupied France. And he was about 9 years old at the time, and he was playing with a friend. And at that time, because Kahneman was a Jew, he had to wear a symbol on his clothes in order to show that he was a Jew. And so he was playing with a friend who's not Jewish, and it got a little late, and it was past the curfew hour, so he had to go home. But he was worried that he would be stopped because he's a Jew and it's after the curfew hour. And so he took his sweater and he turned it inside out so that the symbol would be on the inside rather than the outside. And he started to walk home. And as he was walking home, he saw a German officer approaching him in the opposite direction. And as he got closer, he saw that the German officer was wearing a black uniform. And he was warned that you should avoid Nazi officers with black uniforms. And so as he got closer, he got a little bit more worried. And as he got closer still, he noticed that the Nazi officer was looking at him. And as he got closer, the Nazi officer waved to him to come to him. And as he got closer to the Nazi officer came within arm's length and grabbed him and picked him up and lifted him in the air and it put him back down. And then the Nazi officer reached into his coat, put out his wallet, and took out of his wallet a picture of his grandson and showed it to Daniel. And wanted to show that Daniel looks just like his grandson. Now, both the Nazi officer and Daniel Kahneman had completely different pictures in their mind as to what was happening in that particular scenario. And it is this fast thinking that often leads us astray and makes us stuck in negotiation because we're assuming that we know what the other side is thinking. We're assuming that we know what they want, and we're not openly asking and trying to figure out how we can solve each other's problems. This idea of understanding the other side and also showing the other side that you can identify with them and you can see their perspective is talked about in a book called Never Split the Difference. It's written by an FBI hostage negotiator, Chris Voss. And he talks about how you get hostage takers to give up the hostages. And the Never Split the Difference title is basically when you're negotiating to release hostages, you can't say, you keep four, I'll give me four and we're good. You know, you're trying to get all of them. And you're trying to get the hostage to cooperate and agree on a path forward without everybody getting hurt in the process. And so Chris Voss talks about how the FBI does this. And he says that the secret weapon for the FBI is open-ended questions. It is open-ended questions that allow the hostage taker to tell the negotiator what they're thinking, not to ask directed questions. Did you do this? Or isn't it true that this is what you're trying to achieve? Or not even say anything and assuming that you understand what they're trying to achieve. But instead asking open-ended questions to try to understand the perspective of the other side. And Chris Voss says the ultimate goal is to get the hostage taker to say, that's right. That you ask these questions and you test your understanding to the point where the hostage taker says, that's right. Not you're right. You're right means go away. I don't want to talk to you anymore. But that's right means that you have shown that you have been able to see the world through the eyes of the hostage taker. Not to agree with it, but rather just simply to be able to see it so that we can work together to try to solve that problem. Aristotle, several thousand years ago, analyzed this question of how do you persuade? How do we get people to agree to, voluntarily agree to some type of action? And he understood this, or he described this process in three steps: ethos, pathos, and logos. Ethos is the credibility and believability of the speaker. Pathos is the emotional or moral justification for following the speaker's lead. And logos is the logic for following the speaker's lead. And basically what Aristotle said is that in order to persuade, the most important thing is ethos, the credibility and believability of the speaker. That if you cannot establish your credibility and believability, then the audience is not going to listen to you. And so just as Chris Voss asked open-ended questions to try to understand and connect with the hostage taker and be credible and believable, that effectively did two things in Aristotle's model. One, it showed that the negotiator is sincerely trying to understand the perspective of the other person. And it also emotionally connected the pathos, emotionally connected the hostage taker to the negotiator to the hostage taker, to show the hostage taker that I am trying to solve your problem as well as mine. It's a connection with the audience, the emotional connection with the audience. Because Aristotle said that ethos and pathos is what persuades. Logos does not persuade. Logic does not persuade. Logic just fills in the blank. Once you believe the speaker, once you feel the speaker is right, you will find the logic to justify the actions that the speaker encourages. Now, here's the problem for us as lawyers. When we go to law school, we learn to think like lawyers. And what that means is we turn this model of persuasion, these three steps of persuasion that Aristotle developed thousands of years ago, and we turn it upside down. We assume that logic is most important. The one thing that does not persuade, we assume that passion shouldn't matter. The one thing that Aristotle says you have to connect with in order to persuade people, and we assume that all people are created equal. And we discount the fact that we have to establish our personal credibility and believability with the audience in order to get them to believe and to connect emotionally to follow our lead. Ultimately, this is about building trust. It is about finding a way to get, whether it's a customer or whether it's the audience, to trust us, to believe in us, to follow our lead. And this idea of developing trust was kind of expanded in a book called Positively Connected, where Sam Adderley, who is a mediator, used David Meister's trust equation and kind of changed a little bit a few of the concepts to make it more understandable to us as mediators. He said, trust is like a fraction equation. On the top is credibility, reliability, and vulnerability. The more credible we are, the more likely our audience is going to trust us. The more reliable we are, the more likely our audience is going to trust us. And the more vulnerable you are, the more likely the audience is going to trust you. Vulnerability, the weakness, authenticity of yourself is actually something that invites people to trust you. On the bottom of this equation is self-orientation. And the more we are self-oriented, the more we're interested in ourselves, the more we're interested in what are we going to get out of this deal, the more we're interested in protecting ourselves, the less we trust you. So the more selfless we are, the more vulnerable you are, the more we can gain the trust of our audience, the more that we can break through these impasses and work towards a voluntary agreement. So how do we go from being opponents to being teammates? How do we get to this point of reaching a voluntary agreement? One of the key ways in which we can become teammates as opposed to opponents is that we change the story. We change the story from being on opposite sides of the table to being on the same side of the table. By us collaborating and working together as we on the same side of the table, and we throw our clients and our problems and issues on the other side of the table, and we work together to solve the problems on the other side of the table. That's how we get past an impasse. The problem is that we have in the United States a cancel culture. We are very good at separating people out and saying that some people are not one of us, not part of our tribe. And here is an example where in terms of the NATO countries, we incarcerate more people per capita than anybody else among the NATO countries. And in fact, we're one of the, we incarcerate people more than almost any country in the world. We're very good at dividing our people up and saying you're not part of our tribe. Even with respect to the government, back in 64, 77% of the people thought that the federal government did the right thing just about all the time. And today, it's only about 16% of the people that believe in the government, that we consider ourselves as one, as all together. And it's the same with respect to lawyers, that the public doesn't trust us either. That they, only about 16% of the public thinks lawyers have high or very high honesty and ethics. By contrast, the nurses, every single year that Gallup runs this poll, they come out in the 80% range. They're at the top of the chart every single year. And it goes back to that equation, that trust equation, that the more selfish we are perceived to be, the more self-interested we're perceived to be, the less people trust us. The more selfless we appear, the more people trust us. And if you look at this scale, it kind of follows that pattern of people or professions that we consider to be more selfless are at the higher end of the scale, and the people that we conceive of as being more selfish are on the lower ends of the scale. But it wasn't always like this. Back in 1952, when Nixon was on the vice president candidate on the Eisenhower ticket, there was a slush fund issue that came up, a controversy regarding his use of campaign funds for personal purposes. And there was a lot of talk about him being taken off this presidential ticket and being replaced by someone else. And so Nixon went on television and delivered what is called the Checkers speech. Checkers was his dog, and he talked about his dog. He talked about his wife's coat and a bunch of things. But probably one of the more interesting things about that speech is he cited to Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher reviewing the receipts and approving of those receipts, that back then lawyers were considered not selfish, but selfless and in promoting the rule of law as opposed to protecting their particular clients. In the McCarthy hearings, were stopped when a Boston partner, Joseph Welch, defended an associate in his office and gave that famous line, "Senator, at long last, have you no left Have you left no sense of decency? And that stopped the McCarthy hearings. And this was a lawyer defending another lawyer. In the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court at that time was 9 white men. And yet these 9 white men unanimously issued the Brown versus Board of Education decision and thereby revolutionized and changed the entire history of our law at that point in time. The reason that lawyers had such prominence back then and not so much today was the story we told about ourselves was different. Who we thought we were and how we conveyed that to the rest of the public was different than it is today. In the original canons of professional ethics that was issued in 1909 and existed till 1969, the preamble to that professional canons is entirely on this screen. It was just this one paragraph. And it emphasized our role of giving the public absolute confidence in the integrity and impartiality of the administration of justice. In 1969, the new preamble for the ABA model rules continued to emphasize the rule of law and respect for the dignity of the individual. And again, it was this idea that we were there to promote a free and democratic society, promote things beyond ourselves, selflessly promoting this larger purpose. But in 1983, our story changed, and the emphasis became on zealously representing our client, being zealous advocates. And we even went so far as to say that if two sides are represented by zealous advocates, we can assume that justice will be done. We have no obligation to make sure that justice is done. We can assume justice is done if two sides are represented by zealous advocates. And we became a different kind of attorney, not one that is promoting this rule of law and fairness to everybody, but one who is representing clients. And so back in 1909, the emphasis was on integrity and impartiality. Today, the emphasis is on clients. And the word client appears in the preamble 17 times, and the word zealous appears 3 times. And those words never appeared in the prior versions of the preambles of our ABA model rules. This increase in defending a client looks a lot more selfish than selfless. So how do we, in light of all of this, how do we transform from being zealous advocates into being teammates and being on the same side of the table? Well, again, the goal is a voluntary agreement. And the key to getting a voluntary agreement is this one word, we. That if we think of our objective being how do we reach an agreement, we are more likely to be able to overcome any type of impasse or being stuck in the agreement, because we're not thinking solely about ourselves or our clients and what is good for us and our clients. How do we get there? How do we show that we are interested in we? How do we show that we are interested in solving all of our problems so that we can voluntarily agree? One of the most important things that we have to do to be able to get past these impasses is that we need to be curious. We need to ask open-ended questions so that we can understand the perspective of the other parties that are involved. Classic example is a mother who has 2 children that are fighting over a lemon. And she decides to cut the lemon in half and give half to each of the children. And both of them are unhappy. When she does that, when she cuts the lemon in half and gives it to both children, she is not being curious. She is not wondering, what is each child going to be doing with this lemon? What is the, why are they fighting about this lemon? And her lack of curiosity means that she is relying on her own life experiences. They're her own life experiences, her own perspective, her own view of that chair to decide what is the right thing to do in this particular circumstance, to cut the lemon in half and to give half to each child. Had she asked open-ended questions, she might have found out that one child wants the lemon for the zest to make lemon meringue pie. The other child wants the lemon for the rind to make lemonade. And so had she been curious enough to ask what each child was going to do with this lemon, she might have been able to satisfy both of them 100% by just being curious. So one of the keys to getting to the same side of the table and working together to collaborate to solve the problems of our clients is to ask open-ended questions. Who, what, when, where, how? Tell me more. How do we get here? Where do we need to go? How do we get there? And there's a great book about this written by Alexander Carter, who is a Columbia Law professor, but she was a mediator first and then became a litigator. And so she had this appreciation about how to get people together. You have to show them that you are listening to their particular interests and identifying with them. She has in her book 10 questions, 5 questions that you ask yourself and 5 questions that you ask the other side. But it's 10 questions for any negotiation. And it is this basic concept of trying to understand the other side. The one question that is not included is why. Although why is exactly what we want to know. Why are we having this dispute? Why are you insisting on a particular position? Why does this solution not work? We want to know the answer to why, but the problem with asking why is it goes back to that consistency principle. The asking why forces a party to announce publicly a position, a line in the sand as to why they are taking a particular posture in the negotiations. And once they announce publicly that posture, that position, it becomes very hard for them to back down from that position. And so that's the one question that we don't want to ask because of this consistency. I'd like to demonstrate to you how powerful open-ended questions can be. About a few years ago, I was in charge of the largest oil spill in the Port of Los Angeles. I represented a foreign shipper who was refueling their ship, and they had an overflow. And it contaminated 7 miles of shoreline, and there was oil all over the harbor. And the harbor had to be closed all of a sudden, and it was like COVID-19, where all of a sudden the harbor was shut, and nobody could go in or out, and nobody knew how long it was going to take before we could clean things up and open up the harbor again. In order to process the 2,000 claims that came about as a result of that oil spill, we put together a claims office and tried to figure out a process for resolving all the claims. About 2 days after the spill, we had a meeting with all the potential claimants, and we tried to explain how we're going to process all of their claims. I had hired a claims manager, and he got up on the podium and tried to explain what the process is going to be and how we're going to process all of the claims. He got shouted down. Everybody thought that he was yelling at him and saying, saying our clients were stupid and they shouldn't have had the spill and they messed everything up and they shut down the harbor and they just kept yelling at him and not listening to his explanation to how we're going to process this the claims. So I got up to the podium, and the next person that yelled at me I asked them, what do you think we should do that we're not doing already? And that person said something about communication. And one of my guys was standing next to a big whiteboard that we were using to map out how we're going to clean up the harbor. And he wrote down what that person said. The next person that yelled at me, the same thing. I asked them, what do you think we should be doing now that we're not doing already? And we wrote down what that person said. And each person that yelled at me, I asked the same question. And pretty soon he foot up the entire board. And then this guy in the back of the crowd got up and he said, I don't give a damn about any of this. Where's my money? And at that, this lady in the front row shot up, turned to the back of the crowd and said, sit down and shut up. These guys are trying to help. And I was completely surprised because this group that was in the front row, including this woman, were organizing to bring a mass action against my client. Before the meeting started, they were milling around, getting contact information from everybody to bring a mass action against my client. But the act of asking the open-ended questions, and it's not that I knew what to do at the time. I'm looking back, and now that I'm a mediator, I'm looking back and trying to figure out what happened back then, because at the time I didn't know what happened. But the act of asking an open-ended question not only helped to try to figure out what the audience was thinking, but it invited the audience to be a collaborator. We didn't agree with everything that people were saying, but we wrote down everything that they said. And so it invited them to collaborate with us, to be on the same side of the table to solve this particular problem. And it was amazing because after we had this discussion, that group of people that were organizing against us became our liaisons with a lot of the claimants. And we were able to settle 600 of the 2,000 claims within 2 weeks of the spill and settle all 2,000 within 3 months of the spill. And when I look back on it now, I now realize that that open-ended questions that I accidentally asked had a powerful effect in getting us past this impasse, getting us past this obstacle of being on opposite sides and becoming collaborators on the same side of the table. I find that in the pandemic, one of the greatest things that has happened is that we have these online platforms. And on the online platforms, we get to see people's background, whether it's virtual or the background that they have in their house or office or wherever it is. And we see a lot of things in the background that we would not see if they were in a conference room. And sometimes we see kids and pets and people walking by that we would not see if we were in a conference room. And those backgrounds give us an opportunity to conduct some small talk. And that small talk gives us an opportunity to engage, ask open-ended questions that have nothing to do with the dispute, but allows us to find ways in which we can empathize and identify with all the people that are involved. Not necessarily to agree on anything, but rather to show that we are not so selfish, we're more selfless, to make us all a little more vulnerable and to basically try to get everybody on the same side of the table. Part of the agreements too, in the way in which to get past these impasses, is that we have to expand the possibilities. We can't think only in terms of what's going to happen at trial and what the amounts are, and can't think only in terms of money. We have to expand what the possibilities are and the kinds of things that we talk about. We have to expand the story that we're going to tell in order to get people to agree to a resolution and not be stuck in the binary trial story. In essence, in order to get past this impasse, this being stuck, we have to kind of think of the larger story. How do we get us all on the same page so we can walk together out of this mediation with a story? It doesn't have to be the same story, but with a story that each of us can tell ourselves that makes us want to agree. We have to change perspectives, and we have to think of the problem as being a we problem, not a me or them or us or them problem. Let me give you a couple of examples of how this happens, how we can transform a situation that is focused on me to a situation where we can talk about we. You know, the Obergefell versus Hodges case is a very interesting example. That's a same-sex marriage case. You know, back in 2000, there was a proposition on the California ballot that said that they wanted to amend the Constitution, California Constitution, to say that marriage is only between a man and a woman. And that proposition passed by over 60% of the vote. You know, it was overwhelmingly popular amendment to change our California Constitution to say same-sex to ban same-sex marriage, essentially, and to say that marriage is only between a man and a woman. Some 13 years later, polling indicated that we were in exactly the opposite position, that 60%, or more than 60% of people supported same-sex marriage as opposed to those that opposed. What happened in that interim? One of the main things that happened is Will and Grace was the most popular sitcom on television. And back then, we didn't have all separate streaming channels or anything like that. We generally had a few channels, and we're all watching the same programs. But Will and Grace was the most popular sitcom during this period of time. And it wasn't popular with just a LGBTQ segment of the population. It was popular with everybody. And although the show featured LGBTQ characters, what the storyline told us was that these LGBTQ characters are more like us than different. They have the same problems. They have the same issues. And the identification caused others to come out, and Ellen DeGeneres came out, and Vice President Cheney's daughter came out. And basically, we start to realize that there's a lot more LGBTQ people around us than we imagine. And it normalized the LGBTQ community and in our society. They stopped being an other and became more of us. Basically, the messaging by the LGBTQ community also changed, that rather than saying that back in 2000, the messaging was, we are different and we have a right to be different. The messaging in the 2013 period was, we're just like you. We have families just like you. We have kids just like you. We are just like you. And that identification as being just like everybody else is what causes change in the perspective about same-sex marriage. So how do we go from us and versus them to we? We have to look beyond the game. Here's another story that it kind of exemplifies this idea of looking beyond the narrow perspective of the often on switch of trial or arbitration. Sarah Tuchowski was in a championship college softball game. She is a diminutive woman, and she had never hit a home run in her life. But she got up to the plate, and this is a championship game. She got up to the plate, and she hit the ball out of the park. And she was so excited that she ran to first base and rounded the corner and started going to second base. And the first base coach said, "Hey, Sarah, you got to touch the base." And so she turned back to go to first base, and something popped, and she fell to the ground, and she couldn't get up. She tried crawling to the base, and she finally touched the base, but She couldn't stand up. And so one of her teammates asked if they could pick her up and take her around the bases. And the umpire said, no, it'll be a single if you touch her. And Mary Hoekman was the first baseman on the opposite team. And she asked the umpire, you know, what happens if I touch her? And he said, looked through the book and said, I don't think any problem with you touching. And so Mallory called her right fielder, Liz Wallace, and Liz and Mallory picked up Sarah and touched her foot on second base, on third base, and on at home. And as a result of this home run, Mallory and Liz lost this championship game. But the reason that they did this was Mallory was a home run champion. And she appreciated the idea of having home runs and didn't think it was right for Sarah to have hit the ball out of the park and for it to be counted as a single. And so she fought beyond the game and figured out a way to give Sarah this home run. And you know, this was back in 2008, and I'm still talking about it today. It is looking beyond the limited opportunities of the court. The court can't decide that you should pay overtime. The court can't decide that there should be cross-licensing. The court can't decide whether perhaps a business deal is coming up down the line, so maybe we should give the other side an opportunity to invest in their business deal. Court can't decide that one party should apologize to your party. Court's limited role is an off-and-on switch with a dimmer. But the parties can agree to anything, and that's the opportunity. You have to think beyond the game and think beyond the court's questions. Let me give you an example of this. A few years ago, I was called out to a factory where a employee died in a sand silo. They got sucked on a sand silo, and he died for all the wrong reasons. There was no safety harness. There was no radio. There was no watchman. There was information regarding a person that was trying to clean out the sand silo, and somebody turned it on, and that's how he drowned in the sand silo. And so I got there the morning after this accident occurred, and the district attorney's investigators were there, and the OSHA investigators were there, and they were all trying to figure out what happened and planning to bring felony charges against individuals and the company and OSHA charges as well. While I was there, the shop steward was coming out of a meeting with the investigators. And I stopped him and I asked him, you know, what do you think we should be doing, when this happened? And it's kind of a question I kept asking, I guess, and I didn't realize the impact that it would have. But he said that, you know, a lot of people are really hurting and they're concerned about working at this particular factory because of the safety issues. And so listening to that, we got the management of the company to bring in some mental health professionals to talk to all the employees. We went to the family's house and sat with them and took care of the funeral expenses. We brought in a safety expert to look at all the safety issues and change everything in the factory so that it would be a safer place to work. And then I went to the district attorney and I went to OSHA to see if we could resolve the matters with them. And they said, well, we haven't even brought charges yet. We don't even know what we're going to charge yet. And I said, it doesn't matter. There are people hurting and we really want to get this resolved and try to figure out how we can move forward. And both the OSHA representatives as well as the district attorney thought that this was premature. But I heard from them enough to understand that they were really sincere in terms of wanting to create better working conditions and wanting to take care of employees. And so I told them that basically we're going to give them everything that we have in terms of all the documents and everything that happened before this particular incident. And we're committed to becoming a good citizen from this point forward. We can't change the past. What happened, happened. But we're going to turn over a new leaf and we're going to be a good citizen from this day forward. And I told them that if you got to treat good guys that are willing to cooperate before you've conducted any discovery, before you've brought charges, you've got to treat good guys better than bad guys that are going to be withholding documents and not giving you information. Otherwise, there's no point in being a good guy. And that story of treating good guys better than bad guys was the basis for both the district attorney and OSHA to rethink how they wanted to treat this particular company. And although the company had done everything wrong, the reframing of the story to expose their vulnerability and to increase their selflessness allowed the district attorney and the OSHA people to trust us a little bit more. It also allowed the shop steward to trust us a little bit more. And as a result, when we went to the district attorney and to the OSHA to try to resolve the dispute, the shop steward came with us and we all worked together to try to resolve this claim. And as a result, the charges were filed and dismissed the same day because we'd already worked out all the details of the criminal charges as well as the OSHA charges. But it is this effort to increase our vulnerability, decrease our self-orientation so that we're more selfless, that allowed us to change the story and get us on the same side of the table to try to resolve the problems on the other side. An example of this effort to understand the other side and to think not so much about our own interests, but to understand the other side's problem is Jerry Buss. You know, Jerry Buss owned the Lakers from 1979 to 2013. And during that period of time, he went to the finals. The Lakers went to the finals 16 times. And they won the finals 10 times. And you wonder, how did he do that? How did he take these Lakers and take them to the finals so often and to win so many championships? Most franchises are happy if they win one championship, but he won 10 during the time that he owned the Lakers. Well, at his funeral, his business partner talked about how Jerry Buss is business, and it really exemplified this concept of solving other people's problems. So looking at the problem, not just from your own perspective, but trying to see the problem from the other perspectives. His business partner told the funeral audience that Jerry Buss, when he did business, he would look at the deal from all sides. And if he thought it was fair to all sides, he would do the deal. If he didn't think it was fair to all sides, he wouldn't do the deal. And so one time, you know, he agreed to do a deal, but after the fact, he thought it was unfair to one of the parties. So he threw in a couple of players just to make it fair. Now, think about how you would feel negotiating with Jerry Buss as opposed to another owner that might want to take everything for themselves and try to take as much as they can off the table for themselves and give as little as possible in the negotiations. You know, how would you feel about protecting yourself and opening up and trying to cooperate and work together and work on the same side of the table to solve problems if you were dealing with somebody like Jerry Buss as opposed to somebody who wants to take everything for themselves? What's interesting about Jerry Buss is that he started out as a USC professor, and he used this way of working from the time that he started buying small apartment buildings fixing them up with his friends and selling them. And they did this, and they got bigger and bigger apartment buildings as they were going along. And so by the time he bought the Lakers, he owned the Chrysler building in New York and traded the Chrysler building in New York for the Lakers. And so this idea of looking at the problem from the other side is how we can start to get on the same side to get past the impasses. Talk about small talk. And again, here's an example of how that works, you know, and Chris Boss says that when he goes with the hostage takers, talks to the hostage takers, he wants them to say, that's right, that to affirm that he can see their perspective and he can identify with them, and now they can hear him, and now they can collaborate and work together to try to solve the hostage taking problem. But one of the greatest examples of this small talk and how important it is in terms of resolving disputes and getting past these situations where we're stuck is Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela was imprisoned by the apartheid Afrikaans government for 27 years, 27 years of hard labor. And he had every reason to hate. He had every reason to be resentful. He had every reason to not want to cooperate and to continue to try to seek revenge against the South African Afrikaans government. But instead, he realized that his guards were just as much imprisoned as he was in terms of viewing the world in black and white terms. And he started to extend compassion and understanding to his guards and showing them this reciprocal respect and initiating concern and empathy for their families and what they were doing. And in that manner, he didn't just simply react to what the apartheid government had done to him, but rather he started the reciprocality by extending this idea of understanding and empathy and for the guards and their families. And that resulted in their respect for him, and eventually a level of respect that allowed Nelson Mandela to negotiate a bloodless transformation of the apartheid government in South Africa. That's how powerful this small talk about issues that are not directly involved in the controversy can result in getting out of the impasse and being stuck. All right, let's talk a little bit about techniques. You know, what kind of techniques can we use to try to get on the same side of the table and working together as we? This is how we talk as lawyers. Yes, but, and we start to make our argument. By using this way of talking, we basically discount what the other side said. We're just waiting for our turn to talk. In the improv world, they use this way of talking, yes and. They basically affirm what the other person did or said, and they build on it so that they don't simply stop the other story. They continue the story by listening to the other person's words and actions and try to build on it and continue the story forward. This is described in the book Yes And by the founders of Second City. And it is this idea of continuing the story rather than cutting off the story, of listening and expanding upon what other people are saying. This idea of expanding the discussion avoids being stuck in these binary discussions. It avoids us arguing over and over again about our perspective and how we see the case and all that. And it forces us to try to listen very carefully to what the other side is saying and find out by listening whether there's any commonality that we can draw out of it, or whether there's any avenue that we can take that would be consistent with the positions and interests that the other side is expressing. It also allows us to understand whether we can find a way to use the interests of the other side to blend with our own interests to find a path forward. But it's dependent upon us understanding, liking, and respecting the other side. Another way of thinking about this is the fact that we have different interests is not necessarily a showstopper, that we don't need to have common ground. We can have uncommon ground. We have different valuations of various things, so that something that the other side may think is not that valuable, we may think is very valuable. Or we may want to do something right now, and the other side may have a longer time horizon. And so we can adjust and negotiate between different types of interests that might have risk tolerance. And we can shape the agreement if we understand the interests of the other side. And again, it requires open-ended questions. It requires a lot of probing to try to understand what the underlying interests of both sides are so that we can start to find opportunities. We also need to listen, just like I talked about with respect to the Seidel case. We have to listen to what are the goals of the other side. What are their objectives, and how do we craft the story so that it's a victory for the other side? How do we, describe what we're doing in such a way that the other side thinks that this is a good thing? They want to voluntarily agree to this resolution. One way of exploring the possibilities is to use what if. What if we do this? Not so much I offer this or I demand this, but rather, what if we do this? It's sort of a non-committal kind of thing that allows us to feel out each other and see whether there is a possibility, a path forward that we can both agree on. And while we're doing this, it is so important to listen and observe and see how we can affect each other, how we can use the reciprocality of people to a positive advantage. See how they're reacting, their first reaction to proposals, the what-if proposals. See if there's ways in which we can set out a bunch of alternatives and see which one is more of interest to the other side than the other. Rather than just one offer, one demand, several different possibilities that we're agreeable to that allows us to understand what is important to them and what is not important to them. And in the process, we have to understand that we are messaging. We are letting the other side know what we are interested in. And so we have to be very conscious of what we are messaging in the process of this negotiation. Ultimately, the focus has to be on now. We can't change the past. The past is already done. Whatever happened. We can only change today and tomorrow. And so we are seeking some way in which both sides can walk forward together, because it is not something that we can force the other side to agree to. It is only something that we can collectively and jointly agree to. It is a voluntary agreement that we are seeking. Talk a little bit about mediator's proposal. Mediator's proposal involves this concept of some area, the zone of potential agreement, where you have a sense that the party offering is willing to offer more than the demands of the other side. So there's an overlap between the demands and the offer. When you have NOPA, which is no opportunity for potential agreement, it means that the bottom line of the person making demands is above the ceiling of the party that is making the offers. And so there's a gap between the two sides. And so the mediator's proposal attempts to find that zone of potential agreement or create that zone of potential agreement by getting the parties to a position where you can encourage them to come to some kind of a meeting point between the two sides and all that. there are a lot of people, Mark Lemke and a lot of others, that have much more sophisticated discussions about how you use these mediators' proposals. But mediators' proposal is one way to help the parties try to get on the same table, to get into a common perspective about how the case can be resolved. And the way that it works is both sides are given a number and a certain amount of time to decide. And if both sides agree, then we have an agreement. If one side doesn't agree, then the other side will never know whether they agreed or didn't agree. All they will know that if they don't agree, then there's no agreement. If they said that they agreed, then they know that the other side didn't agree. But basically, the idea of a mediator's proposal is to try to encourage that that center point for an agreement. But one of the problems with mediator's proposals and the idea of brackets is another way of getting to that overlap, is that it is oftentimes limited to the narrow, binary, two-dimensional trial story that would be in trial or arbitration and what that decision might be. Sometimes it's difficult to force the discussion into this trial story. And it's easier to tell larger stories about how and why we should get to a particular point. There are also other tools, and Cialdini talks about social proof and authority and scarcity, looking at other verdicts, looking at what the experts say, being up against a trial so that we have a scarcity of kind to be able to make a decision. These are all other ways in which we can try to encourage the parties to work together to try to resolve this particular dispute. And ultimately, it's about a voluntary agreement. The goal in all of these efforts at getting past an impasse is to get to we. And we get to we by being curious, by looking beyond the off and on switch, by looking to solve the other person's problems, to understand the other person's problem and figure out how we can solve their problem and give them a victory speech as to why they want to agree. And we get there by gaining their trust, by having this small talk that allows us to engage them in discussions that allow them to trust us to work out agreement together. The pandemic introduced a new opportunity for getting past impasses or getting past getting unstuck when we have mediations. At the beginning of the pandemic, when everything shut down, I had a whole bunch of cases that were not ready for mediation. The parties had not yet conducted discovery, and so they didn't have enough information in which to rationally negotiate a resolution. And so what we did was we transformed the meetings on Zoom into 5 to 15 minute status conferences. And we use that 5 or 15 minutes to try to figure out what information each side needed and how we're going to get it to the other side. At the time, we didn't know when there was going to be a trial. And at the time, we didn't know whether we'd go to court for any motions because the courts were essentially closed for all except very emergency motions. And you know, the result of these status conferences was that we were able to engage in a lot of small talk in the 5 or 15 minutes. Looking at backgrounds, we were all stuck at home and we only could speak to people in our households. And so it became a window to the outside in these status conferences. And we started to observe each other's backgrounds and pets and kids and all kinds of things were going on and start to joke and identify with each other. And in the process, we realized that something had changed, The status conference had changed the whole nature of mediations and how to get unstuck. That having status conferences from the very beginning of the case allowed us to avoid a lot of the entrenchment that happens when we are just throwing pleadings and correspondence back and forth to each other. That it allowed us to talk and to find out whether there's ways in which we can avoid the expenses of discovery to try to resolve the case. I think there are a number of things that helped. One, it was very convenient. It didn't take any time at all to get onto a conference call on Zoom and to have a discussion about what information we needed and how we're going to get the other side. Like I said, the status conference was about 5 or 15 minutes. In addition, the format of the Zoom conference was such that all the people were the same size. And so the idea of dominance, of size dominance or anything like that, was sort of eliminated because everybody was about the same size. The camera size or the boxes that we were in were such that we were actually very close to each other. We could see each other's faces in such a way that we could observe reactions of other people to what we're talking about, and which became very useful in terms of getting a sense of what people were really thinking in our discussions. And I think probably one of the most important things about this status conference was that we could see ourselves. And so in a conference room, you can see everybody else, but you can't see yourself. You can't see how you appear to other people. And I think that had an effect in tempering everybody's conduct. People were a lot nicer online than they might have been in person. They could see themselves. They could see the effect that they're having on other people. This status conference also did another amazing thing. It took away the threat as being the way in which we negotiated. The threat of trial. We didn't know when we were going to go to trial. The threat of motions. We didn't know when the courts were going to entertain motions about discovery or anything else. Threat of leaving a mediation was also eliminated because basically everybody was at home already. So where are you going to go? Are you going to turn off your camera and leave the mediation? But you're right there. We could bring you right back by just calling you up and say, hey, come back on the mediation. And so by eliminating threats, we started to negotiate in a different fashion. And I think that resulted in a much, much higher level of resolution of all these cases. And most of the mediations were a lot shorter as a result of this online status conference. Probably the most valuable thing, though, about these status conferences is that we didn't have these marathon sessions anymore. That we could meet and figure out what information did we need that we needed in order to resolve the case. And we could take a break, get that information, or get the right person to come to the mediation to be able to talk about a particular thing. And in this fashion, the mediations actually became segmented as opposed to one continuous time when we depended on exhaustion as the basis for a resolution. You know, now it's a matter of everybody voluntarily agreeing to a resolution. Another thing that came about because of the pandemic that helped us to get past these impasses and get unstuck was an interest in early dispute resolution. And there's an early dispute resolution institute that is started by Peter Silverman, Michael Hawash, and Ann Jordan, who introduced me to this concept of decision trees and a free website that can help us to evaluate cases. This is the website, the QR code there. If you
you put your phone on it, you can go to that website. The only problem with this website is that it's not intuitive in terms of how to use it. And so I'm going to kind of demonstrate a little bit about how we use this particular website. This is a website, Silver Decisions. It's a website out of Poland. And this is the first screen that you will see if you go to silverdecision.pl. If you click on the run box, you'll get a screen that looks like this. And again, because it's not intuitive, it's a little bit difficult to use, but I'm going to show you how it's done. Basically, if you right click on your mouse, you get two choices here, or several choices, but the main one is whether to add decision node or a chance node. And decision node is where we start. And then you'll see that there's two exclamation marks, and that means that this is an incomplete model. This decision tree model is incomplete, and it says the path not ending with a terminal node. There has to be a terminal node in order to complete this decision tree. And so I'm going to make this a little bit bigger. And I'm going to add, by right-clicking again, we can now add a decision node, a chance node, and a terminal node. And so I'm going to add a chance node. This is where we get choices. And again, here you see the double exclamation mark. And it says that this path is not ending with a terminal node. And so, the probabilities do not add up to one. So now I'm going to add a terminal node. And I'll add, and you'll notice there's no exclamation mark now because there is a terminal node. This one choice, it's one, it indicates the probability. So it's a 100% going to this chance node, 100% going to this terminal node. But if I add another terminal node, what happens is it divides the probabilities in half. And so if you look at the probabilities on any one of these legs, you'll see that there's a hashtag under probability. And the hashtag just simply means that the probability will be divided equally between however many legs you have. And so if we added another terminal node, the hashtag divides the probabilities for these outcomes by one third. So in looking at this decision tree, we can start to build a little bit of a model to how to think about the future without actually having to live the future. And so this first leg of the model is what we'll label as the trial. And this is what it's going to take us to get and go through trial. And then next level, it says payout or payoff. And here we have to put in what it's going to cost us to go to trial. And so because it's going to cost us something, it's going to be a negative number. So we're going to put negative, let's say $100,000. So if it's going to cost us a negative $100,000 to go to trial, and if the result in all the probabilities is zero going to trial, the current value, the expected value right now of not going to trial is that we would pay out $100,000. So if we were going to go to trial, it would cost us $100,000. And if we were, the probabilities were we're going to get nothing at our trial, then the value to the defendant would be to pay $100,000. Rather than expend this $100,000. In other words, no benefit in expending the $100,000 going forward. Now, if the likelihood of a high verdict was, say,
$1 million. So we could lose $1 million. So it'd be a negative for the defense. Now, the value of not going to trial, if there's a 33% chance of a high verdict of $1 million, the value is $433,333, right? That's taken into account the cost of trial and the possibility of a negative verdict. So anything less than $433,000 for the defense side might make sense, because it's less than what it's going to cost and the probability of one-third chance. So it's not $1 million. It's a one-third chance of getting $1 million award. And if we thought that the low verdict might be $500,000, again, it's negative, because it's what defense would have to pay out. And there's a 33% chance that it's going to be $500,000, not 33% chance that it's going to be $1 million, and 33% chance that it will be zero, and let's call this the defense verdict. Then the value of the case is $600,000 of not going forward. These are our risks. And we want to avoid these risks, then it's worth paying $600,000 today to avoid these possible risks. And if we thought that the defense likelihood was actually much higher than 33%, and we thought it was more like 60%, then we would put in 0.6, and it would change the equation. And where we have only hashtags, it just simply equals out the probabilities. So 60%, the 40% probabilities divided equally, 20%, 20%. So the 60% chance of defense verdict, now the value is $400,000. And but you can see how we can put in whatever numbers we want. And there's no magic to any of these numbers, but we can put in different numbers that will help us to see what the likelihood of things going forward might be. And we put in our own estimates of what the likelihood is, but it gives us an indication of what that's worth today in today's dollars. So if we could pay less than $400,000, if this is what we think is likely to happen, then it's a better deal than going through this whole process and risking this particular outcome. Now, we can also look at it from the plaintiff's perspective, and say from the plaintiff's perspective, the cost is $100,000, and so again the payoff is a minus $100,000. Oops. So the cost to the plaintiff of going to trial, if they're going to win nothing, is minus $100,000. But if they think that they're going to win $1 million, then it's a positive number, because this is something we're going to keep. So now the case is worth $100,000 going forward, if there's a 20% chance of $1 million verdict. And let's say the low verdict is $500,000.
It's possible.
And again, it's a positive number because it's what the plaintiff would recover. So the plaintiff is better off if they got $200,000 rather than going through and risking this particular scenario. Now, the defense, they might think that defense chances are not 60%, but is only about 40%. They might think it's only 4% chance. And so the value of resolving the case today is $350,000 if this is the risks that we may encounter going forward. And so you can see how the plaintiff's version and defense version are very different in terms of what it looks like and how you evaluate the case. Now, how do you use this? This is not an exercise in everybody agreeing on what the high verdict is, what the low verdict is, what defense defense likelihood is, or anything like that. That's not the purpose of this at all. The purpose is to help people to evaluate what they're thinking, to get out on paper their thoughts about what the future looks like, what the risks of the future look like. And by doing that, we're able to show people what the future looks like without, according to them. Again, the numbers are just numbers. And there's no magic to any of these numbers. It's just a probability analysis, decision tree probability analysis. And so the only purpose of this analysis is to help people to see for themselves what their future looks like according to their own assumptions. You can't use the defense assumptions and impose it on the plaintiff. That's like forcing somebody to agree with a different set of facts. And you can't take the defense, the plaintiff numbers and force it on the defense. The numbers only work for the people that are using them. The only people that they're important to is the ones that are putting these numbers in. So the defense puts in their own numbers, the plaintiffs put in their own numbers. And what they're looking at is not whether this is true or not. They're looking at, given their assumptions, what that future looks like and what that means in terms of what the case is worth today, this expected value number today. And oftentimes you'll see that the expected value number overlaps, even though their assumptions about the numbers and the defense likelihood and the like don't overlap. Just another tool in getting people unstuck. Well, thank you very much for listening to my thoughts about how to get unstuck. How do we get past these impasses, and how do we get on the same side of the table to reach a voluntary agreement? As we talked about, the goal is to think we, to get on the same side of the table and try to understand each other so that we can solve together the problem on the other side of the table. We have to be curious in order to reach that goal. We have to look beyond just the decisions that are going to be made in court and realize that we can agree to anything, and we can understand each other's, if we can understand each other's interests and what we want to get, maybe there is opportunities for other types of agreements that will make sense for everybody. We don't have to be limited by what the court can decide or can't decide. But in order to do that, we have to not think solely about ourselves and about protecting ourselves. We have to try to understand the other side's perspective. We have to try to solve the other side's problems. And we do that by building trust. And we build trust through small talk, through just talking about things unrelated to this particular dispute, so that we can build the kind of trust and relationship that allows us to get on the same side of the table and think as we to solve these problems. Thank you.
You may be eligible for CLE credit in your state. Visit bhba.org/podcasts for more information.